Good morning, people from around the internet. Oh, I said that wrong. Good morning, historians from around the internet. Welcome back to the Old History Podcast, where the goal is to just talk about history. Although the topics for the last couple of weeks, the last several weeks, couple of months, have been politics, discussing just the happenings from early America and trying to understand just what it was our ancestors went through. So before we get into that, I was contacted by, we'll just say some anonymous people for now. They found a bunch of pictures and documents, and they want to donate them to a museum because some of the documents go back to the 1800s, their deeds, some certain pictures and stuff like that. And I'm waiting on them to call me back to figure some stuff out, but they wanted my help to figure out what's what and to make sure it gets into the right museum. And I told them I was glad to help. So right now I'm just waiting on them to call me back to just figure something out so I can get out there. Outside of that, there is no other news as far as old history wise. I'm just taking it kind of slow because I've put out quite a few videos, and I just don't want to burn myself out. So, with all that being said, hope everybody's had some time to reflect on all this stuff that's going on and seeing just how some of what we've learned still plays huge cards in the hand of politics today. It's really interesting to look at. So we'll take a quick break. Right before we do, go give my good friend Jason at the Beard Guy and Friends a look-see, as always. Like I said, the Beard Guy and Friends on Facebook. He's just one man that does it. Just shoot him a message and he'll try his best to take care of you. Good guy. And you can always subscribe to the podcast if you want. It's not required to listen, but it does help me out. And with the way gas prices are going, just keep that in mind. I'm kidding. I'm kidding. All right, take a quick break and get into the podcast. All right, as always, the sources for today, U.S. history, whitehouse.gov, Massachusetts history. The people there that are in charge of the websites write great articles. And if you're looking for historical information, at least about the early part of the United States, give all of those guys a look-see. Very smart people. Thank you. If they listen, thank you to whoever writes these. So the last time we talked about certain treaties with the natives, just trying to understand that. Although that's a very, very deep subject that I cannot cover in one podcast. Last time we covered the treaties and some Native American history. Then we covered some, I believe, of John Adams' presidency, and I believe we covered some of the political parties. So what we'll do today is we'll talk about some of Thomas Jefferson's America, the third president, and switching the national capital. So let's dive right in. So at the time of Thomas Jefferson's America, whenever he came to be president, he was vice president under, I believe, George Washington. Let's see. Let me source that. He became an opponent of President Adams, but was a vice president. Anyway, sorry about the pause there. Anyway, the public was still pretty on edge about how this new government was going to do because, well, they didn't want to have fought so hard to gain independence from Great Britain just to set up this new nation, this new democracy, all this new stuff, just to have it turn right back around into the stuff they just fought. So they were criticizing these politicians pretty harshly. And so that came to be, lots of different events came together to be called what was known as the Revolution of 1800, or at least as Jefferson described his party's successful revolution. The principles of our government, as that of 1776 was in its form. To Jefferson and his supporters, the defeat of the Federalists ended their attempt to lead America on a more conservative and less democratic course. Since the Federalists never again played a national political role after their defeat in 1800, it seems that most American voters of the era shared Thomas Jefferson's view. So this goes back to the whole Federalist-Anti-Federalist argument. You had the Anti-Federalists who wanted to go this way. You know, they were conservative. And then you had the Anti-Federalists. You know, they were straightforward. They were organized. Very organized people. And you can go back a couple of podcasts and you can read all about that. Listen to all that. Thomas Jefferson's election inaugurated a Virginia dynasty. They held the presidency from 1801 to 1825. After Jefferson's two terms as president, he was followed by two other two-term Democratic Republicans from Virginia. They would be James Madison and James Monroe. Regular Democratic Republican majorities in Congress supported their long rule. Political leaders and parties would play a pivotal role in shaping the new nation because they could serve as outlets for large numbers of people to express their opinions about issues of public significance. For Jefferson, for instance, the election of 1800 stands as a second revolution that protected and extended the gains achieved in the Revolution just a few years before. Jefferson and his values serve as a useful organizing tool to think about the changes that America experienced in the first decade of the 19th century. Jeffersonian democracy basically came to be an American ideal, as well as, would also be a remarkably successful political movement. At the heart of both meanings of the term lies the household farm worked by ordinary families. Thomas Jefferson's America marked a victory for the common man, the common farmer, the common worker, as both the ideal embodiment of the American citizen and as a practical reality of who voted. As a result, Thomas Jefferson's America required that new western farmlands be cultivated as an absolute necessity for the future of the Republic. Although Thomas Jefferson's democracy, the Jeffersonian democracy, remains a greatly celebrated American ideal, it is important to recall that in its own day, as well as today, it was subject of harsh and very, very intense criticism. Federalists would never again control national politics like they had in the 1790s, but they still would be a very important aspect of American life, and they offered deep criticism of many Jeffersonian developments. The federal government itself had embraced this ongoing disagreement. The Chief Justice of the Supreme Court throughout the Jeffersonian era, his name was John Marshall, was an ardent Federalist, even while his political opponents controlled elected national office. Marshall consistently supported the supremacy of national power over the states. He led the court in establishing legal precedents to support this view. The most serious flaw in the Second Revolution of Thomas Jefferson's America came from its embrace of slavery. The party's national leaders were slave-owning elites who had no intention of including African Americans in their broadened commitment to democracy. Thomas Jefferson probed the fundamental contradiction between slavery and democracy more eloquently than any American of the day. This led him to conclusions that were far less than revolutionary. Thomas Jefferson repeatedly acknowledged that slavery was wrong, but he never saw a way to eliminate the institution. To Thomas Jefferson, anyway, slavery meant holding a wolf by the ears, quote unquote. It was a danger that could never be released, and more importantly, Thomas Jefferson really couldn't imagine America as a place where free blacks and whites could live together. To him, a biracial society of equality would produce convulsions, quote-unquote, convulsions which would probably never end, but in but end in the extermination of one or the other race. According to Thomas Jefferson himself. Jeffersonian America, or as I'll call it, Thomas Jefferson's America, is a term that helps us enter the contested and deeply contradictory nature of the United States at the start of the 19th century. Grappling fully with its meaning requires the use of sophisticated analytical skills that assess both its strengths and its weaknesses. To merely celebrate or condemn seeing one side but not the other is to judge without attempting to understand. Seeing how the best and the worst of Jeffersonian America were deeply mixed in together continue to inform American life in our transformed circumstances of the 21st century is among the most important pieces of historical inquiry. So that's just a look into Thomas Jefferson's America, and there's more that went on than that, but this is just a brief breakdown talking about a little bit. So when Thomas, we got to talk about some of the stuff that happened to him, the stuff that he dealt with, rather. When he assumed the presidency, the crisis in France had passed, so what he done was he basically cut the budget on army and the navy, eliminated a tax on whiskey, which was already unpopular in the West, and then reduced the national debt by a third. He would send a naval squadron to fight the Barbary pirates, who were harassing American commerce in the Mediterranean. The Constitution had made no provision for the acquisition of new land. Jefferson would suppress his qualms over constitutionally when he had the opportunity to acquire the Louisiana Territory from Emperor Napoleon in 1803. And we talked about the Louisiana Purchase in a previous podcast. During his second term, he was increasingly preoccupied with keeping the nation from involvement in the Napoleonic Wars, although both England and France interfered with the neutral rights of American merchantmen. Thomas Jefferson's attempted solution would be an embargo upon American shipping, but that was unpopular and that didn't really work out. At the end of his presidency, he retired to Monticello and pondered projects as his grand designs for the University of Virginia. French noblemen observed that he had placed his house and his mind on an elevated situation from which he might contemplate the universe, quote unquote. And there's a lot more that he done outside of that. But again, we're just kind of skimming over him. So we'll take us a quick break here, and then we'll talk about when the national capital switched from New York to Washington, D.C. So, the Louisiana Purchase and rapid Western expansion were crucial developments during the early Republic. Sounds like I'm talking about something out of Star Wars here. The early Republic. So, attention there can be misleading. This suggests that the United States rapidly assumed the shape we know today. But most of us paid attention in class know that that's not true. Focusing on how the capital city of the federal government changed in the early years of the nation reminds us of the limited nature of the early central government. There were so many other elements that went into this, but the most basic features of the capital city were unsettled. President Washington first took office in New York City, but when re-elected in 1792, the capital had already moved to Philadelphia, where it would remain for a decade. Fittingly, Jefferson was the first president to be inaugurated in the new and lasting capital of Washington, D.C. in March 1801. The site of the new capital was the product of political compromise as part of the struggle over Hamilton's financial policy. Congress supported the Bank of the United States, which would be headquartered in Philadelphia. In exchange, the Special District of Columbia, to be under congressional control, would be built on the Potomac River. And the compromise had represented a symbolic politic, let me reword that. The compromise represented a symbolic politic of the very highest order. While Hamilton's policies encouraged the consolidation of economic power in the hands of bankers, financiers, and merchants, who predominated in the urban Northeast, the political capital was to be in a more southerly and agricultural region apart from these economic elites. Once the site for the new capital was selected in 1790, President Washington retained Pierre Charles L'Enfant, an engineer and former officer in the Continental Army, to design and lay out the new capital city. His grand plan gave pride of place to the capital building, which would stand on a hill overlooking the flatlands around the Potomac. Along a long open mall connected the legislative building to the river and was to be ordered by varied stately buildings. Radiating out from the Capitol were a number of broad avenues, one of which would connect with the President's House. Much of I don't even know if that's how you say that. L'Enfant? L'Enfant? I don't know. His grand vision was ignored during the 19th century, but starting in 1901, the plan was very vigorously reborn. Of course, today, Washington, D.C. is a very impressive capital city that expresses many central values of the modern United States. It honors the nation's commitment to democracy and political life in impressive government buildings. The Capitol itself also maintains the nation's historical memory in monuments along the mall that commemorate key events and people. Finally, the city also announces the nation's commitment to knowledge and human achievement in the Smithsonian Museums. I'm having a hard time talking today. It's been a week. At the same time, the Capitol also symbolizes less celebrated aspects of modern America. Washington, D.C.'s impressive center around the mall is surrounded by urban poverty, a crisis facing most large American cities. The gulf separating American success and failure is on display nowhere more sharply. Today's Washington, D.C. is a very far cry from the humble place that Thomas Jefferson entered in 1801. At that time, he was just beginning to emerge from a swampy location along the Potomac. The city had claimed only 5,000 inhabitants, many of them temporary residents to serve the incoming politicians. The Senate building had been completed, but the building for the House of Representatives was still to be incomplete, as was the President's House. Thomas Jefferson took office while living in a boarding house. The limited physical stature of the capital city matched the modest scope of the federal government in the early republic, which included at that time only 130 officials. In fact, with the exception of the Postal Service, the national government provided almost no services that reached ordinary people in their everyday lives. Most people in the early republic, the most meaningful political decisions were made at the state and local level. And so that's just stuff to think on. How different it was back then, but how similar things are today. So keep all that in mind and think on it. And as always, thanks for listening. Catch you guys next week.